You're listening to part two of Unwelcome Guests number 583. We continue with the Christian exploration of the realities of Christmas.
Santa Claus is another good example of a pagan element of Christmas. Santa Claus, as we know him today, is an amalgamation of several different traditions. But in most cultures throughout the world, you will find the existence of what is known as hearth gods, gods who guard the hearth and the chimney and keep the fires burning and make sure the food cooks properly and the people are warm and what have you. And at a certain time of year, in the middle of winter, typically, the hearth god, dressed in red, will come down the chimney to reward those who have pleased him during the course of the previous year, and to lay curses or hexes or other forms of punishment upon people who have displeased him.
The concept of Santa Claus has had a long and winding history, with a number of diverse cultures contributing to the composite character we have today. Beginning once again in Scandinavia, Santa's original incarnation was in the form of Odin, the pagan god of thunder. A tall fellow with a long flowing beard who inhabited the spirit-infested Nordic forests. Odin would travel the sky during the winter solstice, deciding who would die and who would prosper. Most believers were frightened of this particular time of year. In England, Odin eventually evolved into Father Christmas, who, crowned with sprigs of holly, traveled the countryside getting roaring drunk as part of the Festival of Fools celebration. Frequently, he would be accompanied by a horned goat, ironically the biblical symbol of those who reject the salvation of Jesus Christ. According to the traditions of the Church of Rome, there was a Turkish bishop named Nicholas who hailed from Myra in Asia Minor during the 4th century. He was known as the patron saint of seafaring men. Over the centuries, as the legend began to unfold, it was rumored that St. Nicholas had actually captured the devil himself, put him in chains, and made him his personal servant. Recognized in various cultures as Krampus, Beelzebub, or Zwart Piet, Black Peter, this assistant of St. Nicholas is best known by his German name, Knecht Ruprecht. Described as a hideous horned creature, the servant Ruprecht was a dark and sinister figure, who stood in stark contrast to the saintly Nicholas. Somehow, Father Christmas's companion, the horned goat, had metamorphosized into the foreboding horned devil called Ruprecht. As St. Nicholas traveled from house to house, inquiring about the behavior of children, Ruprecht would drop candy and gifts down the chimney into the good children's shoes which had been placed there. It was from this story that we get our tradition of hanging stockings on the mantle at Christmas time. If able to recite a verse or demonstrate a skill for St. Nicholas, the child would receive a gift. If unable to remember a verse, or if the child had been bad, he or she would receive a switch or a whip. Ruprecht also carried a large sack which he would frequently use to haul away the really bad boys and girls. As more and more Christian churches began combining the pagan rituals of the winter solstice with the celebration of the birth of Christ, emphasis on St. Nicholas's role began to shift. Some cultures began to downplay the role of St. Nicholas, but surprisingly retained Ruprecht. Eventually, Knecht Ruprecht was made the companion and servant to the Christ child himself. In this scenario, the devil is actually given the title Weihnachtsmann, or Santa Claus. 19th century writer Theodore Storm, in his story about Knecht Ruprecht, even goes so far as to describe the switches given to the children by Ruprecht as tools to be used in sadomasochistic rituals. Soon, the image of Ruprecht would fade from the Christmas tradition, but not his sadistic influence. Many of the early depictions of Santa Claus portrayed him not as a jolly gift giver, but of an unfriendly disciplinarian complete with a ready switch or whip.
One of the problems with the Christmas gift thing for children is that it really is a religious teaching, a wrong religious teaching, because it teaches them that if they're nice, they get the gifts, if they're naughty, they don't. Or in my case, I was taught that he would leave us a bundle of switches. Isn't that interesting? It's a salvation by my own personal virtue. But there's a second thing wrong with it, and that is that they're going to get those gifts whether they're naughty or nice, because most parents love their children and wouldn't dream of, quote, ruining their Christmas, and they're not going to ruin Christmas. They're going to give those children the gifts anyway, and sooner or later those thinking children are going to realize, I wasn't very nice, but I got the gift anyway. So it isn't important to be nice. It isn't important to do what is right and avoid what is wrong.
German immigrants coming to America during the 1620s tried to influence the New World with the stories of St. Nicholas and his gift-giving companion, Necht Ruprecht. But somehow the idea just didn't take hold until almost 200 years later. In 1819, America's best-selling author, Washington Irving, used his influence to promote St. Nicholas in a popular Christmas story titled Bracebridge Hall. Consulting Irving's writings, Episcopalian minister Clement Clark Moore penned a decidedly secular tale called A Visit from St. Nicholas in 1822. Later retitled The Night Before Christmas, Moore's poem was based on the tales of German and Dutch immigrants who had come to America. Intended originally only for his own children, Moore's story was published in the Troy Sentinel in New York and became an overnight sensation. Gone were the bishop's remnant of St. Nicholas. He was now a jolly old elf imbued with supernatural powers. Moore had also replaced Nicholas's companion, the horned Necht Ruprecht, with 8 horned magical reindeer. As the popularity of The Night Before Christmas grew, Moore became increasingly concerned that the story's emphasis on the supernatural and its disregard for Christ would reflect poorly on his position as a minister. As a result, he refused to take credit for its creation until the story became so popular that he could no longer resist. 40 years later, illustrator Thomas Nast, political cartoonist for Harper's Weekly, seared the image of Santa Claus into the minds of the world by creating a drawing which combined Moore's jolly old elf with images of St. Nicholas taken from his own native Bavaria. By 1880, Santa was a thoroughly secularized folk hero who had become increasingly irresistible to retailers worldwide.
One factor that has contributed to the paganization of Christmas, the complete paganization of Christmas, has been the element of commercialism. It may seem odd to think of it in that context, but remember that Christ himself identified the love of money as a spiritual force in and of itself. And where it comes into play, it has a kind of naturally hostile effect on the gospel and the Christian faith. So the commercialization of Christmas has helped to highlight the pagan elements and to drive the overtly Christian elements further underground.
To me, the most obscene thing about Christmas celebrations and customs as we know them is that as a result of these things, Jesus is displaced in the hearts of children by Santa Claus. The love, affection, appreciation, trust, the desire to emulate, these things that they should have in their hearts and minds as growing children for Jesus himself, to whom they owe everything. Instead, this has been stolen. This has been raped out of their hearts, in a sense, and displaced by the myth of Santa Claus.
He takes the place of God or of Jesus Christ in the special world that is Christmas. He has supernatural knowledge of your history. He has supernatural knowledge of your present, of your attitudes. He's keeping a list. He knows who's naughty and nice. Your parents don't even know that. He's obviously got some conduit to knowledge that is beyond the human. And he flies through the air. He's capable of visiting every place on the globe in the course of a single night. In many, many ways, Santa exhibits supernatural qualities that provide a kind of a surrogate deity or a substitute for God or for Christ.
Myths, by definition, evolve and change, and things are added. We used to have a Santa Claus figure that was confused with Saint Nicholas and confused with other pagan figures, and then somehow he evolved through the drawings of Thomas Nast and others into what we see today. But he had a sleigh with 8 supernatural reindeer that can fly. And so the Christmas traditions that are pagan continue to change. But the truth of Jesus, the truth of the Incarnation, the truth that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, never changes, never will.
Various scriptures in the Bible, including the second chapter of Luke, record the events surrounding the birth of the Messiah. A decree from Caesar Augustus had gone out, requiring all people to return to the city of their origin for taxation purposes. Mary, who was pregnant with a child conceived by the Holy Spirit, made the difficult journey to Bethlehem along with her husband Joseph. Both Joseph and Mary were of the lineage of King David. Upon arrival, they found all the inns to be full, but were provided with a stable where Mary could have her baby. At the same time, an angel announcing the birth of the Messiah appeared to shepherds tending their flocks in a field nearby. The stunned shepherds hurried to Bethlehem and found the baby Jesus lying in a manger just as the angel had declared. Although traditional nativity scenes place three wise men at the stable at the time of Jesus Christ's birth, according to scripture, these wise men visited Jesus later at his home. Because three gifts are named, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, tradition says three men gave them. But exactly how many wise men visited Jesus is not known. The birth of Jesus Christ miraculously fulfilled a number of Old Testament prophecies about the coming Messiah, including that he would be born in Bethlehem, that he would be born of a virgin, and that he would be a descendant of King David's.
The concept or the idea of celebrating the birth of Jesus once a year had apparently never occurred to the church fathers. In the first three centuries of the church's history, there was no such thing. And I think God perhaps very carefully avoided telling us in the scriptures when he was born. We can be sure of one thing, it wasn't in late December, and because in the first place, shepherds don't abide by their flocks in the fields by night in late December. It's too cold. They take them out in the morning to pasture, protect them while they eat all day, and then bring them back in at night. So it wasn't in late December. It's an interesting thing, and perhaps an intellectually tantalizing thought, to try to figure out when he was born. And it can be done within limits, and if it mattered, and apparently it doesn't matter to God, he was probably born in late September.
Some scholars point out that according to scripture, the birth of Jesus may have taken place in the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles or September 29th. Ironically, this would have placed his conception right around December 25th. The timing of other events such as the temple service of Zacharias and the pregnancy of Mary's cousin Elizabeth lend credence to December 25th as being the date of Jesus' conception. Since Christians believe that life begins at conception anyway, and not at birth as pro-abortionists believe, this may be a more appropriate reason to remember this time of the year as the period in which God came to earth in human form. For some, Christmas today simply means a time to get together as a family. For pagans, it is a deeply religious time to celebrate the winter solstice. Retailers, of course, view it with eyes towards making huge profits. Others use this time to reflect on the birth or conception of Jesus Christ, while many parents use Christmas to perpetuate the myth of Santa Claus to their children.
In order to carry on this myth of Santa Claus, we must lie to our children. We must deceive them. We literally must lie to our children. And one of the wonderful things about children is that they naturally believe everything that we tell them when they're small. They trust us to tell them the truth. And if we deceive them in this way, it has to be destructive, because at some point in their future lives, they're going to wonder if other things we told them were true. The things we told them about the Lord, were they really true? It plants the seeds of doubt. And anyway, it creates disappointment. It creates disillusionment.
To my mind, the question is not so much whether to celebrate Christmas or even how to celebrate Christmas, but to be able to make any decision knowledgeably. Whether you celebrate it or you don't celebrate it, you should know why you're doing so. You should understand what the pagan roots of Christmas are, and with that knowledge, You can discount them or ignore them if you choose to do so.
And there's another few minutes of that if you want to hear the rest of it on the video. Now, Christmas comes but once a year, and if for whatever reason you feel like saying, look, I'm not very interested in Christmas, I'm just going to ignore it, then it's no great shakes. Compare and contrast that with the money system, which for most people in most countries, I think, they are pressured to take part in on a daily basis. Now, in case this strikes one as absolutely normal, remember that historically this is a very new phenomenon. We're going to conclude the show by reading the end of chapter 6 from David Graeber's Debt the First 5,000 Years, in which he reminds us that when it was first introduced, there was no way that money was applied to the things that people needed to live, so that both rich and poor alike were guaranteed survival through the traditional mechanisms. Now, only gradually has money come to assume such prominence that it's a matter of life and death. As somebody who is working on developing gift economies, this strikes me as very important and suggests a design for citizens' income that could differentiate things that people need, which we should not allow to become scarce resources controlled by a few, from other less essential items. I find Graeber's analysis very interesting, and if you have any thoughts on the matter, I would love to hear them. And now let's continue where we left off, reading chapter 6.
Horror stories always seem to reflect some aspect of the teller's own social lives, some terrifying potential in the way they're accustomed to interact with each other that they do not wish to acknowledge or confront, but also cannot help but talk about. In the Tiv case, what would that be? Clearly, Tiv did have a major problem with authority. They lived in a landscape dotted with compounds, each organized around a single older man with his numerous wives, children, and assorted hangers-on. Within each compound, that man had near absolute authority. Outside, there was no formal political structure, and Tiv were fiercely egalitarian. In other words, all men aspired to become the masters of large families, but they were extremely suspicious of any form of mastery. Hardly surprising, then, that Tiv men were so ambivalent about the nature of power that they became convinced that the very qualities that allow a man to rise to legitimate prominence could, if taken just a little bit further, turn him into a monster. In fact, most Tiv seemed to assume most male elders were witches, and that if a young person died, they were probably being paid off for a flesh debt. But this still doesn't answer the one obvious question. Why is this all being framed in terms of debt? Here a little history is in order. It would appear that the ancestors of the Tiv arrived in the Benue River Valley and adjacent lands sometime around 1750, a time when all of what's now Nigeria was being torn apart by the Atlantic slave trade. Early stories relate how the Tiv, during their migrations, used to paint their wives and children with what looked like smallpox scars, so that potential raiders would be afraid to carry them off. They established themselves in a notoriously inaccessible stretch of country and offered up ferocious defense against periodic raids from neighboring kingdoms to their north and west, with which they eventually came to a political rapprochement. The Tiv, then, were well aware of what was happening all around them. Consider, for example, the case of the copper bars, whose use they were so careful to restrict, so as to avoid their becoming an all-purpose form of currency. Now, copper bars had been used for money in this part of Africa for centuries, and at least in some places, for ordinary commercial transactions as well. It was easy enough to do. One simply snapped them apart into smaller pieces, or pulled some of them into thin wires, twisted those around to little loops, and one had perfectly serviceable small change for everyday market transactions. Most of the ones current in Tivland since the late 18th century, on the other hand, were mass-produced in factories in Birmingham and imported through the port of Old Calabar at the mouth of the Cross River by slave traders based in Liverpool and Bristol. In all the country adjoining the Cross River, that is, in the region directly to the south of the Tiv territory, copper bars were used as everyday currency. This was presumably how they entered Tiv land. They were either carried in by peddlers from the Cross River or acquired by Tiv traders on expeditions abroad. All this, however, makes the fact that the Tiv refused to use copper bars as such a currency doubly significant. During the 1760s alone, perhaps 100,000 Africans were shipped down the Cross River to Calabar and nearby ports, where they were put in chains, placed on British, French, or other European ships, and shipped across the Atlantic. Part of perhaps 1.5 million exported from the Bight of Biafra during the whole period of the Atlantic slave trade. Some of them had been captured in wars or raids, or simply kidnapped. The majority, though, were carried off because of debts. Here, though, I must explain something about the organization of the slave trade. The Atlantic slave trade, as a whole, was a gigantic network of credit arrangements. Ship owners, based in Liverpool or Bristol, would acquire goods on easy credit terms from local wholesalers, expecting to make good by selling slaves, also on credit, to planters in the Antilles and America, with commission agents in the City of London ultimately financing the whole affair through the profits of the sugar and tobacco trades. Ship owners would then transport their wares to African ports like Old Calabar. Calabar itself was the quintessential mercantile city-state, dominated by rich African merchants who dressed in European clothes, lived in European-style houses, and in some cases even sent their children to England to be educated. On arrival, European traders would negotiate the value of their cargoes in the copper bars that served as the currency of the port. In 1698, a merchant aboard a ship called the Dragon noted the following prices he managed to establish for his wares. One bar of iron was worth 4 copper bars. One bunch of beads, 4 copper bars. One basin number 1, 4 copper bars. One tankard, 3 copper bars. One yard of linen, 1 copper bar. 6 knives, 1 copper bar. One brass bell number 1, 3 copper bars. By the height of the trade 50 years later, British ships bringing in large quantities of cloth, both products of the newly created Manchester mills and calicoes from India, and iron and copperware, along with incidental goods like beads and also, for obvious reasons, substantial numbers of firearms. The goods were then advanced to African merchants, again on credit, who assigned them to their own agents to move upstream. The obvious problem was how to secure the debt. The trade was an extraordinarily duplicitous and brutal business, and slave raiders were unlikely to be dependable credit risks, especially when dealing with foreign merchants whom they might never see again. As a result, a system quickly developed in which European captains would demand security in the form of pawns. The sort of pawns we're talking about here are clearly quite different from the kind we encountered among the Lele. In many of the kingdoms and trading towns of West Africa, the nature of pawnship appears to have already undergone profound changes by the time the Europeans showed up on the scene around 1500. It had become, effectively, a kind of debt peonage. Debtors would pledge family members as surety for loans. The pawns would then become dependents in the creditors' households, working their fields and tending to their household chores, their persons acting as security while their labour, effectively, substituted for interest. Pawns were not slaves. They were not, like slaves, cut off from their families, but neither were they precisely free. In Calabar and other ports, masters of slaving ships, on advancing goods to their African counterparts, soon developed the custom of demanding pawns as security. For instance, 2 of the merchants owned dependents for every 3 slaves to be delivered, preferably including at least 1 member of the merchants' families. This was in practice not much different than demanding the surrender of hostages, and at times it created major political crises, when captains, tired of waiting for delayed shipments, decided to take off with a cargo of pawns instead. Upriver, debt pawns also played a major part in the trade. In one way, the area was a bit unusual. In most of West Africa, the trade ran through major kingdoms such as Dahomey and Ashanti to make wars and impose draconian punishments. One very common expedient for rulers was to manipulate the justice system so that almost any crime was to be punishable by enslavement, or by death with the enslavement of one's wife and children, or by outrageously high fines, which, if one could not pay them, would cause a defaulter and his family to be sold as slaves. In another way, it's unusually revealing, since the lack of any larger government structures made it easier to see what was really happening. The pervasive climate of violence led to the systemic perversion of all the institutions of existing human economies, which were transformed into a gigantic apparatus of dehumanization and destruction. In the Cross River region, the trade seems to have seen two phases. The first was a period of absolute terror and utter chaos, in which raids were frequent, and anyone travelling alone risked being kidnapped by roving gangs of thugs and sold to Calabar. Before long, villages lay abandoned. Many people fled into the forest. Men would have to form armed parties to work the fields. This period was relatively brief. The second began when representatives of local merchant societies began to establish themselves in communities up and down the region, offering to restore order. The most famous of these was the Arrow Confederacy, who called themselves Children of God. Backed by heavily armed mercenaries and the prestige of their famous oracle at Arochukwu, they established a new and notoriously harsh justice system. Kidnappers were hunted down and themselves sold as slaves. Safety was restored to roads and farmsteads. At the same time, Arrow collaborated with local elders to create a code of ritual laws and penalties so comprehensive and severe that everyone was at constant risk of falling afoul of them. Anyone who violated one would be turned over to the Arrow for transport to the coast, with their accuser receiving their price in copper bars. According to some contemporary accounts, a man who simply disliked his wife and was in need of brass rods could always come up with some reason to sell her, and the village elders, who received a share of the profits, would almost invariably concur. The most ingenious trick of the merchant societies, though, was to assist in the dissemination of a secret society called Ekpe. Ekpe was most famous for sponsoring magnificent masquerades and initiating its members into arcane mysteries, but it also acted as a secret mechanism for the enforcement of debts. In Calabar itself, for example, the Ekpe Society had access to a whole range of sanctions, starting with boycotts — all members were forbidden to conduct trade with a defaulting debtor — fines, seizure of property, arrest, and finally execution, with the most hapless victims left tied to trees, their lower jaws removed as a warning to others. It was ingenious, particularly because such societies always allowed anyone to buy in. Rising through the 9 initiatory grades if they could pay the fee — these also exacted, of course, in the brass rods the merchants themselves supplied. In Calabar, the fee schedule for each grade looked like this, and the bottom 5 grades cost 50 boxes of brass rods each to advance, whilst the top 4 grades cost 300 boxes of brass rods each. And there's an equivalent in pounds sterling. 1 box of brass rods is £2.09. So to advance through one of the top 4 grades, you're paying £735. In other words, it was quite expensive, but membership quickly became the chief mark of honour and distinction everywhere. Entry fees were no doubt less exorbitant in small, distant communities, but the effect was still the same. Thousands ended up in debt to the merchants, whether for the fees required for joining or for the trade goods they supplied, mostly cloth and metal, put to use creating the gear and costumes for the Ekpe performances. Debts that they thus themselves became responsible for enforcing on themselves. These debts, too, were regularly paid in people, ostensibly yielded up as pawns. How did it work in practice? It appears to have varied a great deal from place to place. In the Afikpo district, on a remote part of the Upper Cross River, for instance, We read that everyday affairs, the acquisition of food, for example, was conducted, as among the Tiv, without trade or the use of money. Brass rods, supplied by the merchant societies, were used to buy and sell slaves, but otherwise mostly as a social currency, used for gifts and for payments in funerals, titles, and other ceremonies. Most of these payments, titles, and ceremonies were tied to the secret societies that the merchants had also brought to the area. All of this does sound a bit like the Tiv arrangement, but the presence of the merchants ensured that things were very different. Quote, "In the old days, if anybody got into trouble or debt in the upper parts of the Cross River and wanted ready money, he used generally to pledge one or more of his children, or some other members of his family or household, to one of the Akuna Kuna traders who paid periodical visits to his village. Or he would make a raid on some neighbouring village, seize a child, and sell him or her to the same willing purchaser." Unquote. The passage only makes sense if one recognizes that debtors were also, owing to their membership in the secret societies, collectors. The seizing of a child is a reference to the local practice of pannieri, current throughout West Africa, by which creditors, despairing of repayment, would simply sweep into the debtor's community with a group of armed men and seize anything, people, goods, domestic animals, that could most easily be carried off, then hold it hostage as security. It didn't matter if the people or goods had belonged to the debtor, or even the debtor's relatives. A neighbour's goats or chicken would do just as well, since the whole point was to bring social pressure on whoever owed the money. As William Bosman put it, "If the debtor be an honest man and the debtor just, he immediately endeavours, by the satisfaction of his creditors, to free his countrymen." It was actually a quite sensible expedient in an environment with no central authority, where people tended to feel an enormous sense of responsibility toward other members of their community and very little responsibility toward anyone else. In the case of the secret society cited above, the debtor would presumably be calling in his own debts, real or imagined, to those outside the organization, in order not to have to send off members of his own family. Such expedients were not always effective. Often debtors would be forced to pawn more and more of their own children or dependents, until finally there was no recourse but to pawn themselves. And of course, at the height of the slave trade, pawning had become little more than a euphemism. The distinction between pawns and slaves had largely disappeared. Debtors, like their families before them, ended up turned over to the Arrow, and then to the British, and finally, shackled and chained, crowded into tiny slaving vessels, and sent off to be sold on plantations across the sea. If the Tiv, then, were haunted by the vision of an insidious secret organization that lured unsuspecting victims into debt traps, whereby they themselves became the enforcers of debts to be paid with the bodies of their children, and ultimately themselves, one reason was because this was literally happening to people who lived a few hundred miles away. Nor is the use of the phrase flesh debt in any way inappropriate. Slave traders might not have been reducing their victims to meat, but they were certainly reducing them to nothing more than bodies. To be a slave was to be plucked from one's family, kin, friends, and community, stripped of one's name, identity, and dignity, of everything that made one a person, rather than a mere human machine capable of understanding orders. Neither were most slaves offered much opportunity to develop enduring human relations. Most that ended up in the Caribbean or American plantations, though, were simply worked to death. What is remarkable is that all this was done, the bodies extracted, through the very mechanisms of the human economy, premised on the principle that human lives are the ultimate value, to which nothing could possibly compare. Instead, all the same institutions, fees for initiations, means of calculating guilt and compensation, social currencies, debt pawnship, were turned into their opposite. The machinery was, as it were, thrown into reverse, and, as the Tiv also perceived, the gears and mechanisms designed for the creation of human beings collapsed on themselves and became the means for their destruction. I don't want to leave the reader with the impression that what I'm describing here is in any way peculiar to Africa. One could find the exact same things happening wherever human economies come into contact with commercial ones, and particularly commercial economies with advanced military technology and an insatiable demand for human labor. Remarkably similar things can be observed throughout Southeast Asia, particularly amongst hill and island people living on the fringes of major kingdoms. As the premier historian of that region, Anthony Reed, has pointed out, labor throughout Southeast Asia has long been organized, above all, through relations of debt bondage. Even in relatively simple societies little penetrated by money, there were ritual needs for substantial expenditures, the payment of bride price for marriage, and the slaughter of a buffalo at the death of a family member. It is widely reported that such ritual needs are the most common reason why the poor become indebted to the rich. For instance, one practice, noted from Thailand to Sulawesi, is for a group of poor brothers to turn to a rich sponsor to pay for the expenses of one brother's marriage. He's then referred to as their master. This is more like a patron-client relation than anything else. The brothers might be obliged to do the occasional odd job, or appear as his entourage on occasions when he still has to make a good impression, not much more. Still, technically, he owns their children and can also repossess the wife he provided if his bondsmen fail to carry out their obligations. Elsewhere, we hear similar stories to those in Africa, of peasants pawning themselves or members of their families, or even gambling themselves into bondage, of principalities where penalties invariably took the form of heavy fines. Frequently, of course, these fines could not be paid, and the condemned man, often accompanied by his dependents, became the bondsman of the ruler, of the injured party, or of whoever was able to pay his fine for him. Reed insists that most of this was relatively innocuous. In fact, poor men might take out loans for the express purpose of becoming debtors to some wealthy patron, who could then provide them with food during hard times, a roof, a wife. Clearly, this was not slavery in the ordinary sense. That is, unless the patron decided to ship some of his dependents off to creditors of his own in some distant city like Majapahit or Ternate, whereupon they might find themselves toiling in some grandee's kitchen or pepper plantation like any other slave. It's important to point this out, because one of the effects of the slave trade is that people who don't actually live in Africa are often left with an image of that continent as an irredeemably violent and savage place, an image that has had disastrous effects on those who do live there. It might be fitting, then, to consider the history of one place that is usually represented as the polar opposite. Bali, the famous Land of 10,000 Temples, an island often pictured in anthropological texts and tourist brochures as if it were inhabited exclusively by placid, dreamy artists who spend their days arranging flowers and practicing synchronized dance routines. In the 17th and 18th centuries, Bali had not yet obtained this reputation. At that time, it was still divided among a dozen tiny, squabbling kingdoms in an almost perpetual state of war. In fact, its reputation among the Dutch merchants and officials, ensconced in nearby Java, was almost exactly the opposite of what it is today. Balinese were considered a rude and violent people, ruled by decadent, opium-addicted nobles, whose wealth was based almost exclusively on their willingness to sell their subjects to foreigners as slaves. By the time the Dutch were fully in control of Java, Bali had been turned largely into a reservoir for the export of human beings, young Balinese women in particular being in great demand in cities through the region, as both prostitutes and concubines. As the island was drawn into the slave trade, almost the entire social and political system of the island was transformed into an apparatus for the forcible extraction of women. Even within villages, ordinary marriages took the form of marriage by capture, sometimes staged elopements, sometimes real forcible kidnappings, after which the kidnappers would pay for a woman's family to let the matter drop. If a woman was captured by someone genuinely important, though, no compensation would be offered. Even in the 1960s, elders recalled how attractive young women used to be hidden away by their parents, forbidden to bear towering offerings to temple festivals, lest they be espied by a royal scout, and hustled into the closely protected female quarters of the palace, where the eyes of male visitors were restricted to foot level. For there was slim chance a girl would become a legitimate low-caste wife of the Rajah. More likely, after affording a few years' licentious satisfaction, she would degenerate into a slave-like servant. Or, if she did rise to such a position that the high-caste wives began to see her as a rival, she might be either poisoned or shipped off overseas to end up servicing soldiers at some Chinese-run bordello in Yogyakarta, or changing bedpans in the house of a French plantation owner in the Indian Ocean island of Reunion. Meanwhile, royal law codes were rewritten in all the usual ways, with the exception that here the force of law was directed above all and explicitly against women. Not only were criminals and debtors to be enslaved and deported, but any married man was granted the power to renounce his wife, and by doing so, render her, automatically, property of the local ruler, to be disposed of as he wished. Even a woman whose husband died before she had produced male offspring would be handed over to the palace to be sold abroad. As Adrian Vickers explains, even Bali's famous cockfights, so familiar to any first-year anthropology student, were originally promoted by royal courts as a way of recruiting human merchandise. Quote, "Kings even helped to put people into debt by staging large cockfights in their capitals. The passion and extravagance encouraged by this exciting sport led many peasants to bet more than they could afford. As with any gambling, the hope of great wealth and the drama of a contest fueled ambitions which few could afford, and at the end of the day, when the last spur had sunk into the chest of the last rooster, many peasants had no home and family to return to. They and their wives and children would be sold to Java." Unquote. Reflections on violence. I began this book by asking a question. How is it that moral obligations between people come to be thought of as debts, and, as a result, end up justifying behaviour that would otherwise seem utterly immoral? I began this chapter by beginning to propose an answer, by making a distinction between commercial economies and what I call human economies, that is, those where money acts primarily as a social currency, to create, maintain, or sever relations between people, rather than to purchase things. As Ross Barbet so cogently demonstrated, it's the peculiar quality of such social currencies that they're never quite equivalent to people. If anything, they're a constant reminder that human beings can never be equivalent to anything, even ultimately to one another. This is the profound truth of the blood feud. No one can ever really forgive the man who killed his brother, because every brother is unique. Nothing could substitute, not even some other man, given the same name and status as your brother, or a concubine who will bear a son who will be named after your brother, or a ghost wife who will bear a child pledged to some day avenge his death. In a human economy, each person is unique, and of incomparable value, because each is a unique nexus of relations with others. A woman may be a daughter, sister, lover, rival, companion, mother, age mate, and mentor to many different people in different ways. Each relation is unique, even in a society in which they are sustained through a constant giving back and forth of generic objects such as raffia cloth or bundles of copper wire. In one sense, these objects make one who one is, a fact illustrated by the way the objects used as social currencies are so often things otherwise used to clothe or decorate the human body, that help make one who one is in the eyes of others. Still, just as our clothes don't really make us who we are, a relationship kept alive by the giving and taking of raffia is always something more than that. This means that the raffia, in turn, is always something less. This is why I think Ross Barbet was right to emphasize the fact that in such economies, money can never substitute for a person. Money is a way of acknowledging the very fact that a debt cannot be paid. But even the notion that a person can substitute for another person, that one sister can somehow be equated with another, is by no means self-evident. In this sense, the term human economy is double-edged. These are, after all, economies, that is, systems of exchange, in which qualities are reduced to quantities, allowing calculations of gain and loss, even if those calculations are simply a matter, as in sister exchange, of 1 equals 1, or, as in the feud, of 1 minus 1 equals 0. How is this calculability effectuated? How does it become possible to treat people as if they are identical? The Lely example gives us a hint. To make a human being an object of exchange, one woman equivalent to another, for example, requires first of all ripping her from her context, that is, tearing her away from that web of relations that makes her the unique conflux of relations that she is, and thus into a generic value capable of being added and subtracted and used as a means to measure debt. This requires a certain violence. To make her equivalent to a bar of camwood takes even more violence, and it takes an enormous amount of sustained and systematic violence to rip her so completely from her context that she becomes a slave. I should be clear here. I am not using the word violence metaphorically. I am not speaking merely of conceptual violence, but of the literal threat of broken bones and bruised flesh, of punches and kicks. In much the same way that when the ancient Hebrews spoke of their daughters in bondage, they were not being poetic, but talking about literal ropes and chains. Most of us don't like to think about violence. Those lucky enough to live relatively comfortable, secure lives in modern cities tend either to act as if it doesn't exist, or, when reminded that it does, to write off the larger world out there as a terrible, brutal place, with not much that can be done to help it. Either instinct allows us to not have to think about the degree to which even our own daily existence is defined by violence, or at least the threat of violence. As I've often noted, think about what would happen if you were to insist on your right to enter a university library without a properly validated ID. And to overstate the importance, or at least the frequency, of things like war, terrorism, and violent crime, the role of force in providing the framework for human relations is simply more explicit in what we call traditional societies, even if in many, actual physical assault by one human on another occurs less than in our own world. Here's a story from the Bunyoro Kingdom in East Africa. Quote, "Once a man moved into a new village. He wanted to find out what his neighbours were like, so in the middle of the night he pretended to beat his wife very severely to see if the neighbours would come and remonstrate with him. But he didn't really beat her. Instead he beat a goat skin while his wife screamed and cried out that he was killing her. Nobody came, and the very next day the man and his wife packed up and left that village and went to find some other place to live." Unquote. The point is obvious. In a proper village, the neighbours should have rushed in, held him back, demanded to know what the woman could possibly have done to deserve such treatment. The dispute would become a collective concern that ended in some sort of collective settlement. This is how people ought to live. No reasonable man or woman would want to live in a place where the neighbours don't look after one another. In its own way, it's a revealing story, charming even. But one must still ask, how would a community, even one the man in the story would have considered a proper community, have reacted if they thought she was beating him? I think we all know the answer. The first case would have led to concern. The second would have led to ridicule. In Europe, in the 16th and 17th centuries, young villagers used to put on satirical skits, making fun of husbands beaten by their wives, even to parade them about the town, mounted backwards on an ass for everyone to jeer at. No African society, as far as I know, went quite this far. neither did any African society burn as many witches. Western Europe at the time was a particularly savage place. Yet, as in most of the world, the assumption that the one sort of brutality was at least potentially legitimate, and the other was not, was the framework within which relations between the sexes took place. What I want to emphasize is that there is a distinct relation between that fact and the possibility of trading lives one for another. Anthropologists are fond of making diagrams to represent preferential marriage patterns. Sometimes these diagrams can be quite beautiful. And there's quite a beautiful symmetric-looking diagram entitled Ideal Pattern of Bilateral Cross-Cousin Marriage. Sometimes they merely have a certain elegant simplicity, as in this diagram on an instance of Tiv-sister exchange. And there's an elegantly simple diagram. Human beings, left to follow their own desires, rarely arrange themselves in symmetrical patterns. Such symmetry tends to be bought at a terrible human price. In the Tiv case, Akiga is actually willing to describe it. Quote, "Under the old system, an elder who had a ward could always marry a young girl, however senile he might be, even if he were a leper with no hands or feet. No girl would dare to refuse him. If another man were attracted by his ward, he would take his own and give her to the old man by force, in order to make an exchange. The girl had to go with the old man, sorrowfully carrying his goatskin bag. If she ran back to her home, her owner caught her and beat her, then bound her and brought her back to the elder. The old man was pleased, and grinned till he showed his blackened molars. 'Wherever you go,' he told her, 'you will be brought back here to me. So stop worrying and settle down as my wife.' The girl fretted till she wished the earth might swallow her. Some women even stabbed themselves to death when they thought they were given to an old man against their will. But, in spite of all, the Tiv did not care." Unquote. The last line says everything. Citing it might seem unfair. The Tiv did evidently care enough to elect Akiga to be their first parliamentary representative, knowing he supported legislation to outlaw such practices. But it serves nicely to bring home the real point that certain sorts of violence were considered morally acceptable. No neighbours would rush in to intervene if a guardian was beating a runaway ward, or if they did, it would be to insist that he use a more gentle means to return her to her rightful husband. And it was because women knew that this is how their neighbours, or even parents, would react, that exchange marriage was possible. This is what I mean by people ripped from their contexts. The Lele were fortunate enough to have largely escaped the devastations of the slave trade. The Tiv were sitting practically on the teeth of the shark, and they had to make heroic efforts to keep the threat at bay. Nonetheless, in both cases, there were mechanisms for forcibly removing young women from their homes, and it was precisely this that made them exchangeable. Though in each case, too, a principle stipulated that a woman could only be exchanged for another woman. The few exceptions, when women could be exchanged for other things, emerged directly from war and slavery, that is, when the level of violence was significantly ratcheted up. The slave trade, of course, represented violence on an entirely different scale. We're speaking here of destruction of genocidal proportions, in world historic terms, comparable only to events like the destruction of the New World civilizations or the Holocaust. Neither do I mean in any way to blame the victims. We need only imagine what would be likely to happen in our own society if a group of space aliens suddenly appeared, armed with undefeatable military technology, infinite wealth, and no recognizable morality, and announced they were willing to pay $1 million each for human workers, no questions asked. There will always be at least a handful of people unscrupulous enough to take advantage of such a situation, and a handful is all that it takes. Groups like the Arrow Confederacy represent an all too familiar strategy deployed by fascists, mafias, and right-wing gangsters everywhere, first unleash the criminal violence of an unlimited market in which everything is for sale and the price of life becomes extremely cheap. Then step in, offering to restore a certain measure of order, though one in which its very harshness leaves all the most profitable aspects of the earlier chaos intact. The violence is preserved within the structure of law. Such mafias, too, almost invariably end up enforcing a strict code of honour, in which morality becomes, above all, a matter of paying one's debts. Were this a different book, I might reflect here on the curious parallels between the Cross River societies and Bali, both of which saw a magnificent outburst of artistic creativity. Cross River Ekpe masks were a major influence on Picasso, that took the form, above all, of an efflorescence of theatrical performance, replete with intricate music, splendid costumes, and stylized dance, a kind of alternative political order, as imaginary spectacle. At the exact moment that ordinary life became a game of constant peril in which any misstep might lead to being sent away. What was the link between the two? It's an interesting question, but one we can't really answer here. For present purposes, the crucial question has to be, how common was this? The African slave trade was, as I mentioned, an unprecedented catastrophe, but commercial economies had already been extracting slaves from human economies for thousands of years. It is a practice as old as civilization. The question I want to ask is, to what degree is it actually constitutive of civilization itself? I'm not speaking strictly of slavery here, but of that process that dislodges people from the webs of mutual commitment, shared history, and collective responsibility that make them what they are, so as to make them exchangeable, that is, to make it possible to make them subject to the logic of debt. Slavery is just the logical end point, the most extreme form of such disentanglement. But for that reason, it provides us with a window on the process as a whole. What's more, owing to its historical role, slavery has shaped our basic assumptions and institutions in ways that we're no longer aware of, and whose influence we would probably never wish to acknowledge if we were. If we've become a debt society, it's because the legacy of war, conquest, and slavery has never completely gone away. It's still there, lodged in our most intimate conceptions of honour, property, even freedom. It's just that we can no longer see that it's there. In the next chapter, I'll begin to describe how this happened.
And that's the end of Chapter 6. Chapter 7, Honour and Degradation, or On the Foundation of Contemporary Civilization, I suspect will start next week. I got a busy week. On Wednesday, I'm speaking at a conference in Berlin on the history of plutocracy, which I might include in next week's show if I get a recording. Now, it's the 31st of December next week, so that would be a reasonable time for predictions. If you've got any thoughts about what you think the future holds for 2012, do you expect to be using nationally issued fiat currency this time next year, for example? What new measures will nation states be resorting to suppress dissent and perpetuate a climate of fear, I wonder? I'd like to hear your thoughts. If you send them my way, I might read them out on air. Now, if you like this show or have feedback on it, you can contribute to the discussion about it, unwelcomeguest.net/583. All previous episodes are available from that website, and there's an index by category, by topic, by speaker, and an RDF feed so you can subscribe via iTunes. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Happy Christmas, come holidays, come winter solstice, and thank you for listening.